Hi, well, welcome everybody. This today we're joined by Jackie Reed. I think that I've known Jackie for 30, maybe 40 years, and she's one of the great inventors in Chicago. And Jackie, welcome. We're glad
you
could be here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you, John, as always.
And I wonder if we couldn't begin by having you give us a little background on your history and what led you to focus on the issue of health.
Yes. I grew up in Natchez, Mississippi, and I grew up during a time when Natchez was segregated. I went to segregated schools, and I lived in a segregated community, but we never felt poor. We had a sense of pride and dignity. Education was very important to our families. My mother had 11 years of education. My father couldn't read and write, but they had a lot of hope, and they had dreams for their children. And so we grew up with a strong sense of family and a strong sense of community. We grew up with a sense of dignity about our community and believing that we could do anything. And I'm 64 years old, so I'm a child of the 50s and 60s. And I came to Chicago when I was 18, and I came here because there weren't many jobs down south, and I was looking for a job to work that summer so I could save up money to go back to school. I was going to Alcorn State University. It wasn't a state. It was a private college at the time. And I met my husband, and I got married, and I stayed here. And so it was quite a big difference here because the people had more. I was living in Lawndale. The people had more, but they didn't have a sense of sacrificing and demanding more out of themselves. It seemed to be people were into having and living for the moment, having a good time. Now, don't get me wrong, because I liked it. All of a sudden, didn't have to worry about school and sacrifices. I could go partying on Saturday nights and work and get paid, and the guys had more money and the cars, and so, you know, we could have a good time, and I had a sense of freedom, but there was always something in me that that said that I had to prepare for my future. I had to help somebody. You know, growing up, we always had seen people helping each other. If somebody had chickens, then everybody had eggs, you know, and people had gardens, and people could eat out of each other's gardens. And, you know, I remember my daddy raised hogs in the country, and when he would bring a hog back, you know, we would have to cut that hog up and work with that hog and take, you know, this neighbor a piece of this leg and that neighbor a piece of the shoulder. And by the time we finished giving that hog away, we only had a little bit of that hog ourselves. But this was the way people lived, and we came to understand that what people thought about us was very important. And, you know, we had hope, and we had a community, and we had a future, and people, you know, they did the usual things. They got in each other's business and so forth, but people really cared about each other. So this is the value. These are the values that I grew up with and I came to Chicago with. And so I made friends. I came to Chicago. You take friends out to lunch in Chicago, and you say, oh, no, I have the bill. And I found out that they let you have the bill. So, you know, and this was the time when they were doing outreach to find people who wanted to get on welfare. They actually did outreach. And so people in the neighborhood would say things like, you know, you could go down to the welfare office and tell them that you're not married, and, you know, you can get a welfare check and so forth. So a lot of people, you know, did that, and they were working, and they got dressed on, went out on Friday nights. They spent money, and, you know, they used bad language on the streets, and they didn't care if children were there. So I saw a breakdown, is what I'm saying, of the values and the morals that people grew up with. And I know that these people had grown up in families from Mississippi, from Alabama, from Arkansas, just as I had. But somehow, you know, they did not have the same sense of identity and purpose and drive for that community that we had. And I think part of it was we had a clear sense of what we had to do for ourselves because the community, the white community, the power structures in the South were so organized against civil rights movement. In Chicago, it was, you know, much more sublime. You really couldn't tell because the aldermen were black and they could fight to get chickens, and the mayor was Mr. Daley, and, you know, there was this sense that he's going to take care of you some kind of way. So it was a different level of awareness about the political structures and what were possible. So, you know, that's the way I grew up, and I like Chicago, and I moved to Chicago on the west side. But I started to work in factories. I went to school. I paid my own tuition. I didn't know anything about getting money to help pay tuition. They told me that I wouldn't do well in school because I had gone to segregated schools, and I didn't find the University of Illinois to be particularly challenging. It was fine, but it wasn't, you know, I didn't feel threatened or somehow inferior there. You know, I did very well there, and I finished my degree in sociology and went on to University of Chicago later on. But, you know, just basically having babies along the way. I have four children and struggling and paying bills and, you know, trying to feel out what is my purpose and what is my sense and what can I contribute.
So somehow you got, I'm sorry, somehow you got into the health field. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, I started out of my church at Bethel. They were looking for a director. I had worked in practically every area of social work, and I was now in the church, and they needed a director. I had become, you know, pretty famous in the church in my work in social work. I had been working with children needing adoptive homes, and I ended up placing more children in adoptive homes than any other social worker in the state, black families, and finding black families for black children. And so Bethel wanted me to consider being the director. So I became the director of a holistic health center. And, John, when I was director of the health center, I was also a social worker. I also did pastoral counseling. And, you know, it was very interesting there because even though I didn't know anything about managing a health center, many of the people who came in there really didn't come in there with a lot of health problems. They came in there with a lot of community or social problems. The woman whose son was staying at home and he was on drugs and he was stealing all the baby's formula, going and selling it. The mother who the girl who's pregnant by her mother's boyfriend. So we saw a breakdown in families, and so you know the intervention was more social rather than medical, and so we thought to ourselves that, you know, what is health and how do we go about creating health in this community? And so that was one of the things that plagued me. And I went to the universities and trying to get partnerships between the universities. And one of the things universities came out and they, you know, they would look at, I would call it a flavor of the month, you know, such that now we have all these girls having babies, so how are we going to, because that's one of the reasons why you have the family problems. Too many teenagers having babies. And so, you know, maybe what we need to do is, you know, put some birth controls in the schools and have more clinics in the schools that can dispense birth controls. And so you come back to the neighborhood, and neighborhood people say, well, no, that's not going to work, you know, because basically, you know, this is what they said. This is giving girls permission to have sex, and this is basically legitimizing their behavior and not teaching them to restrain their behavior, not teaching the young men to restrain their behavior. What are the values and the morals that we want to promulgate to our young people rather than just giving them a pill? And then you had the problem, another flavor of the month, of course, was infant mortality. And we have this high infant mortality. More babies are dying in Chicago than in Costa Rica. So what are we going to do about that? So they say, well, we need to do outreach to get that young mother into the clinics. If we can get that mother into the clinic during the first trimester of her pregnancy, the babies won't die. So it didn't become about the mother. It became about her womb. How can we get this womb to this doctor's office in time so we can say, you know? And somehow it was not a focus on people. It was a focus on the problem. And somehow they would find a quick fix for the problem, but the problems – people are more complex than a womb. They're more complex than their sexuality. So, you know, all of these things. And any time we would do something, you know, the politicians, you know, wouldn't necessarily listen to us, you know, because, you know, if you had a problem with drug abuse in the neighborhood, the people would say, we need to have more drug treatments and we need to have something for these young men to do. The politicians would say, yeah, we're going to lock them up. You know, so you lock up the people on drugs, you take the womb to the hospital so that they can get prenatal care. And, you know, so everything is about a problem. It's about something that we can quick fix it and let's get on with the next flavor of the month. And I just got fed up with it, you know, because people then begin to look for this outside quick fix to come in here and dope us up or lock us up or something. And people lost their sense of what we can do for ourselves. And because this was something that was based in research and because it was something that was qualitative and all of those other ways that methodologies that was more legitimate than my little idea, people lost their confidence in their ability to make a difference in their own community. So they would go and they would listen to what a researcher has to say, and the researcher would give them some incentive for coming. You know, they would, you know, so you come to this thing here and you're pregnant, we're going to give you some Pampers, or we're going to give you something that's going to, a baby bed, so you have a baby bed when you're, all of these things, you know. So it's not really respecting people, and people need respect, and, you know, people need to maintain a sense of dignity and a sense that they themselves have the solution. So, you know, I left that organization after about 4 years. And I said, the hell with this. What we're going to do is just to try. Every time we would go and get some program, the people would say, well, that's not what we really need. So let's go and hear what the people say. And based on what the people say, we're going to put a strategy around that and work on what the people say. And so that's how we started the Westside Health Authority. We said we're going to use the ideas of people. We're going to use their capacity to make a difference in their community. We're not going to get wrapped up in organizational interests. Because they have to worry about big money and interest, then the organization will use people. We want to be an organization that people would use. We want to be able to get people's ideas transverse from one point to the next point. We want to build their capacity up to carry forth work in their community, make change in their own community. So that's how we really got started with the Westside Health Authority.
Hello?
Yeah.
I just heard a song. I'm sorry. I was just wondering, you have the name Westside Health Authority, the group that was formed. And most people, when they would hear something called an authority, would think it's governmental. And but you didn't call it the Westside Health Organization. Can you tell us why you chose the word authority?
Well, we believe that the people really are the authority on what needs to happen. I mean, if you look at all the professionals and all the dollars that have been spent on the west side of Chicago, just to give you an example, in healthcare, you know, you have that one program that was to reduce infant mortality. I think somewhere around $30 million was being spent over there in a period of 10 years. And then you have all these hospitals. You have five hospitals alone. They're probably spent somewhere around $250 million a year in healthcare, and all of this, and all the people doing is getting sicker and sicker and sicker. So we believe that the people themselves really are the authority on what needs to happen in the community. And we believe that if we hear the people and listen to the people and follow what the people say and give the people an opportunity to use their ideas, to use their capacity, we would create health in the community. And
what
by
kinds
health,
of things, what kind of things did you do?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What did
well,
the people, Jackie, this is Peter,
yeah.
What you said, I'm interested in what you're saying is just mesmerizing, so
yeah.
Thank you. But I'm interested in what did the people say?
Well, we did that. We went out on the doors, right? We went out and knocked on doors, and we got a grant from MacArthur Foundation. They took a chance on us. And I actually had gone to MacArthur Foundation and asked them for some money to hire some people from the community so they could go out into the neighborhood to
mm-hmm.
ask people, you know, what was health, what did they think was working in the community so we could build on that rather than what's not working. And MacArthur said that we had to go to the university and get somebody from the university to help us. So I went to the university, and I told them that we are the authority and that we are the boss, and that if they were willing to work for us, that we would give them a grant, part of our grant. And so they were willing. I knew people there. I had graduated from the university, so I had, you know, some friends there. And so we hired a woman from the university to come and work with us. And she started to work with us back in, I think, around 90, and she just retired actually about 6 months ago. So she ended up quitting the university and working for us. But we asked a question in the community. We trained 15 people from the neighborhood to go out and ask their neighbors, you know, what do they think would work in the community? What was health, and how could we make the neighborhood healthier? And the people say, well, you know, I really don't know anything about health, but, you know, I wish that we could do something about that, those gunshots behind my garage on Saturday nights. And so, you know, we ask them, well, what could we do about the gunshots, you know? And they say, well, you can't do anything about that unless you do something about jobs. These young people are not like they were when I was kids. When I was kids, nobody had money, and, you know, we were satisfied to go outside with no money and be okay. But now everything, you see television, everything is about money, and the kids don't feel like they're worth anything if they don't have any money, so we have to create some jobs for them. And so, and then somebody else would say, well, you can't create jobs unless you have some businesses. And so, you know, we need more businesses right here in our neighborhood. Everything that we buy, we have to go to Oak Park, or we have to go to some other neighborhood from other people and buy. We don't have our own economy right here in our neighborhood. And then somebody will say, well, you can't just build a community and have a healthy community just because you have kids and you have a few jobs. Because if you have, if you don't teach morals and values, if you don't have that as your foundation, the jobs will leave and the businesses will dry up. And so, you know, so we're just listening to what people are saying, and we looked at what we have, and what we had was we have four hospitals in that neighborhood, and these four hospitals were also around the table with us because they had their own organizational interests. They were competing for patients. And because we had the community's ear and the community's voice, they wanted to make sure that they were plugged into us. And so we used that and leveraged those hospitals. We work with five schools and those hospitals to help to get 291 young people into internships. Now, the hospitals will provide a preceptor for the young people to come there. They will learn about they would be in work in the hospital pharmacy. They would work in food service. They would work in the gift shop. They would work going around visiting patients, taking books, library, you know. They worked in the accounting office. So they learned all kinds of skills. And we didn't cream anybody. These were whoever wanted to participate from these five schools. And these young people got so, they saw themselves different. And they began to have hope. And they began, and their grades improved. And the families began to brag about what their sons were doing now. And they weren't gangbanging, and they weren't hanging out now as much. But they were paid, too, to do this because so many of these young people have their mamas at home, their aunties who's taking care of them is on kidney dialysis, and the phone is getting ready to be shut off, and she has to have the phone because that's her lifeline connection, or, you know, the light bill. So they don't have money, and so that this money that we were able to raise for them through the Mayor's Office of Workforce Development, which is the right way for the mayor to spend their money. This is a good thing for the city of Chicago to do. And so we were able to get them stipends so that they could actually go to their workplace. We got the community colleges to come in there and train them on how to do various kinds of skills so that they could actually learn from not only being from the preceptorships, but they could also have some formal training from Malcolm X Community College, Wright Junior College. The colleges all came in there. And our mission, as I said, was not to, this is very hard work. Our mission was to go out of business. So we were always looking at ways that we can make a difference in terms of public policy so we could get this thing implemented citywide. And so in 3 or 4 years, you know, as I said, we had gotten 291 young people internships, paid internships, and they ended up, we got Walgreens to pick up some of them and train them in pharmacy, PharmDs, and, you know, we got a lot of build partnerships for them, and the city of Chicago liked the project. The public school hired our staff and took over the project, and they call it Schools to Work Project, and our staff is still working there. And she told me that she makes twice as much and she does half as much, so it works out. But the business piece of it, people said schools and businesses. How do you build businesses in these neighborhoods? We have been trying to do that forever, so we were able to get these same hospitals to tell us who supplied their lights and who pressed their sheets and who provided catfish for the trays. So we were able to get businesses in the neighborhood to supply that need as well. But the real beauty of we were able to raise, like, these entrepreneurs. We got Ma and Pa paint companies out of basements to paint the kitchen for Loretta Hospital. We got MK Cleaners to do the cubicles, the curtains for West Suburban Hospitals. We were able to help these companies to get $3 million over a period of 3 years, 3.5, 4 years. And this became a model for the Empowerment Zone when the Empowerment Zone legislation was passed. And we worked with the city to put together an RFP to do more of that. And then the third thing, the big thing, though, the real foundation of our work is called Every Block a Village. How do we get to the business? So you can get some businesses created because you have a lot of people who aspire to do businesses. And as long as you're willing to help them to clean up their portfolios, as long as you have to introduce them to the procurement offices at the hospital, well, how do you get people to change their values and morals? And how do you get people willing to commit themselves to helping their neighbors and, you know, things that they will not get paid for? And so, you know, maybe what we could do would be to find a citizen leader on every block and try to turn every block into his own village. Maybe on this one little block here, if we can get the neighbors connected to each other, understanding each other's needs, maybe we could turn this block around. Maybe they would know who their kids are and then tie that block into another block. So we organized 6 to 3 blocks, and we call it Every Block a Village. And we brought people together off of these blocks every month, and they began to talk about their blocks, and they began to talk about their children, and they began to talk about their vision. They remembered the way it was when they were in Mississippi and Alabama. And then we began to ritualize these relationships. We built relationships with these folks so that they would take each other soup. They would take each other to the store. They would go to the pharmacy for a sick neighbor. And we began to ritualize this. We would bring them together for Thanksgiving potlucks, and everybody would bring a pot, and they would smile and grin with each other, and their children would see us smiling and grinning with each other. And so when you saw the children on the street acting up, all of a sudden you could say, now you shouldn't be doing that. You're not afraid of that kid anymore. And when you saw some kids hanging out in front of your house, you're not calling the police saying that they're drug dealers. You know those kids out in front of your house now. They just don't have any place else to go. So you're talking to them, what are you doing out here? So that you are building relationships with your neighbors. You are establishing some rituals and patterns for celebrating each other. And you're feeling good. People would say, I was sick before all of this. I had this terrible disease, you know, and I didn't feel like coming out to this meeting, but I sure feel better now. They feel a sense of satisfaction and a fulfillment from them giving their gifts. That's what I call health. Health is having a satisfaction and a sense of fulfillment, you know, because you have a purpose for living, and that purpose propels you to do something, to give to somebody, and that makes you want to do more. The more money you get, the more you want to share. The better you feel, the more you go out there and work not only in your garden but help your neighbors to cut their grass. So it's a sense of being fulfilled, and I think that when people are just on their dependency end of it, they lose their sense of purpose, and they lose their sense and hope for their destiny. We have the biggest health problem we have in our neighborhood, particularly among our youth, is hopelessness. I'll stop there. I'm sorry. I get going.
Yeah. Jackie, one other thing. I know that when I was attending meetings of the citizen leaders at the EBV, Every Block a Village meeting, you always started with a prayer. Various ones of the citizen leaders lead a prayer, very, very extensive prayer, ended with a prayer. And then one time I remember you and I went and interviewed in their homes some of these citizen leaders, and I think one of the things that became very clear there was that they saw the base of what they were doing as an expression of their faith over and over again. That's what we would hear. And I wonder if you could talk about the historic church and the question of faith and how that gets manifested at the block level in the organization.
Yes, it you know, when we first started Every Block of Village, we had people in the neighborhood who were Muslims and we had Christians. So, you know, and of course we have staff who are Jews and we have staff who are very educated and have no faith. But, you know, we just had to be who we were. You know, I've had staff who were Muslims, so we don't discriminate. You know, they are all, you know, very lovely people, and they have all made tremendous contributions. You know, but the idea here is that you have to believe that God is in charge and that God is with you when you are trying to help other people. You know, this notion about, you know, the spirit really is about loving other people. And, you know, you can't have love unless you are in a relationship with other people. I mean, to have the spirit and not be in a relationship with other people is like having eyes but keep them closed. So, you know, it is the beauty of the spirit to be shared and to share your life with someone else. And that makes you better and that makes them better. And so, you know, I think that everybody knew that. Most of the people are Christian, and they don't go to the same church. Most of them go to different churches, but they have, they express their love for God, you know, how they love their neighbors. And that's very, you know, that's very Christian. That's very, I think, probably Islamic, too, that you love God by loving people, and you exhibit your love for God by the way you help other people. And so, you know, we always emphasize the fact that people had to give of themselves, and it is in the giving of yourself that you really do benefit the most. The person who gives is the one that benefits the most. And, of course, that's also scripture. Jesus says that it is more blessed to give than to receive, and it is in the giving that you receive. It is when you keep yourself and when you hold on to your stuff that your life dwindles away and that you become fearful, you become hopeless. But when you give yourself to other people, because even if they are unlovable, you are doing it because you love God, you know. And so you give people a chance because you love God, and it's a spiritual thing. It's a spiritual principle.
I wonder if, Maggie, are we in a place, Peter, you have something you wanted to raise, or whether we're ready?
I have one more. The leaders, tell me how you launched a block leader, and what did they do in the early days?
Well, the it takes, in order to really connect somebody with someone else, you know, to call them a citizen leader, we gave them the name, you know. So the name went on, I would say, before necessarily they were actually providing leadership. We gave mm-hmm. them that name. We had some clear expectations for them, and the expectations included them getting to know who was on their block. The expectation, okay. They also had to come to the meetings. They also had to bring somebody to the meetings with them. Mm. And they had to represent their block on the meeting, at the meeting, so that they would say that my name is, I am Orlene Huntley from the 5400 block of of West Haddon. And, you know, so she would give a block report. And when something would happen, when there was some project going on, let's say October's coming up, so every October we would have what we call Oktoberfest. And that was because, you know, based on people's ideas about Halloween, we didn't want to get into that. So we would have Oktoberfest, and the people would come, and they would bring gifts for the children. They would have apple bob and activities in the park. They would supervise them. So, you know, they would basically plan what they were going to do at Oktoberfest. And mm-hmm. they would get flyers out on their block about Oktoberfest. They will go to meetings if we needed to have people teaching physicians, for example, what health was in the neighborhood. You know, we had trained some of the citizen leaders to actually go down to Cook County and to talk to the doctors. So all of this was building their capacity as a leader, not only among their neighbors, but also with professionals, because professionals are a part of the community too. So the training, and of course, if they went down to county and provided training, then county had to pay them consulting fees for coming down there. And so they were, they learned language, new language. They learned the language of the medical professions, primary care, ambulatory care, whatever else. You know, they learned the language. But they were also responsible for knowing who was sick on their block. And, you know, they would make sure that a card got out. And, you know, they would bring a card to the every block of village meeting, and 50 people would sign on that card so that the people felt connected to each other. Even people who weren't necessarily off of each other's blocks, you know, they felt connected. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Maggie, should we open it up for call-ins?
Sure. Sure, let's do that now. If you are listening in on the telephone and would like to share a question or a thought with Jackie, Peter, or John, press star 8 on your phone. And I'll see that you are calling in and I can unmute you. Or if you have a question you'd like to post in the chat, maybe more about Jackie's experience with the West Side Health Authority. That was an interesting story. I loved hearing that. We do have a question in the chat, and it's from Max Johnson, one of our friends in Cincinnati. Can you share what's worked to help nonprofit staff to shift to ABCD's approach from only needs to develop citizens versus clients?
Yeah, that was one of the hardest jobs that I had to do. We actually had gotten funding to do the ABCD model, but all the people we hired, they wanted to be helpers. They wanted to go out and help people. And it was difficult to get them to understand their job was to go out and organize helpers from the community. And it takes a certain kind of organizer. I just got very, very fortunate to get somebody who was from Mississippi who had organized in the civil rights movement, and they knew how to go out and find people to organize. They didn't go out and do all the helping. They actually were successful at doing that. And so he has been with me no matter where I go. He's been with me for about 30 years. But he was very, very instrumental, and, you know, he knew how to go out and mobilize people. So what we try to do is to get people going out to the community, and they have to first not go out to see who need and see who's sick and see who need more food, but they have to go out to bring people into a meeting. And they have to let people know how bad they need these folks to come to this meeting. So they have to build a relationship first with Ms. Huntley, and Ms. Huntley has to see them. So, you know, a lot of times you knock on somebody's door and, you know, they will ask you, why aren't you guys doing more about these drugs in the neighborhood? Or why aren't you doing something about these schools in the neighborhood? Or I got a mama here is sick and she can't get her medical card. And why can't you help me to get her medical card? So, you know, you have to listen to all of that. You have to show concern and be real authentic concern for people. But you have to keep your vision ahead of you. And then you have to come back and have a place to come back and debrief about your visits. So when you come back, mm-hmm. you know, you'll have to say to people, what did you learn? And they'll start telling you about all the needs, and then I'll start saying things like, okay, that's fine, but what are the assets? And then people would, you know, sometimes they would say, well, what we need to be doing more is to help these people. And so you'll say to them, okay, well, how are we going to help them? So you have to listen, and it's a process by which they get transformed. It doesn't happen overnight because people have been trained, you know, in this dependency role to need help. So it's very, very difficult to get people to see themselves as the help. And you have to keep, you know, that's why you have these meetings. That's why you have to get one or two people who are the strong leaders to really have a voice that keeps repeating it. I'd like to share a story with you a little bit about one of the things that happened. And it blew my mind, too. We had a lady by the name of Diane Scott. We had organized people in the neighborhood to be on a community health board for a Cook County clinic that came in the neighborhood. And these ladies would go to the meetings, and they'd come back, and they'd say, well, the space is too small. We need to have another clinic built. And so one lady, Ms. Scott, said, well, I think we ought to build a clinic. And so she says, we say to our children every day to go to school, and they have to go to schools where they don't have books and teachers who are not there to really teach them. They have to listen to the gang taunts, and they have to walk through gang territories and be threatened. And meantime, we're in our comfort zone. We need to build a facility here. They need to see something. And so she organized a group of the citizen leaders from the different blocks, the women. They got together, and they started selling catfish dinners. And we said to the county that if we build a building, will you rent it? And they said yes, but they didn't have any real clue that we were going to actually build a building. I didn't either, actually, because we had never done it before. But these ladies started selling catfish dinners, and the men would come in. The men didn't fry fish, but they came in, and they took orders, and they would take catfish dinners downtown to different office buildings every Friday. And they ended up raising about $60,000 worth of catfish dinners. They got fish donated from the fish markets in the neighborhood. They got cornmeal from Jim's grocery store on the corner, and they ended up raising about $60,000. And so it was serious then. I mean, they had made a believer out of me, and they had made a believer out of themselves. And I said to the foundations, I said, you know, we have $60,000, and county says that if we build them a building, they would rent it from us. So, you know, are you going to help? So they say, yes, how much is it going to cost? And we say, well, we have this consultant who is pro bono, and he says it's probably going to cost somewhere around $4.5 million. They say, well, I'll tell you what, if you raise the $4 million, we give you $500,000. So we said, okay. And so then we went to another foundation, and we said, well, that foundation said they're going to give us $500,000. So what are you going to do? They say, well, you know, if they're giving you $500,000, we give you $300,000. So we went on, and then the Empowerment Zone money became available, and we went down to the Empowerment Zone board, and all the ladies went there on a morning, and they had asked for $3.5 million. And you have to go before a group of people, and the people decide, you know, and you have the audience packed, and the audience can be with you or against you. So by us having a neighborhood, the whole neighborhood went down there, and there wasn't any room for anybody else. And so when they started voting on what to do with the money, we ended up with $2.5 million. And then the state said, well, if you raise that kind of money, they're going to give us $1 million. So we raised the money to build this building, and county signed the contract, and then we had to actually build the building. We didn't know anything about contracting out and bidding out and all of that, but we hired a guy to help us. And the neighborhood people said to us, we sold catfish dinners. We do not want to see all these other folks coming in this neighborhood doing this work. This has to be our work. Our young people have to do this work. So we said that we were going to make this a black project from the community. We had a young guy there by the name of Kenny. I can't think of his last name, but anyway, he had a trucking company. And so he got so excited about this project that he got the boys who were out on the corner training bulldogs on Sunday mornings to come work for him. He put hard hats on them. He put them on crane operators, crane machines, and had them down in a hole digging. He had about 15 of them, more than he needed, but he was giving them an opportunity. And, of course, they didn't have union cards, and so the union came out and said they were going to stop us from working. And so the community came out and said, you will not do that. And the union say, pay for one of the guys, you can continue to work. So we were able to have our people learning and feeling good about this work. And after Kenny's and we had R.S. Scott, another black concrete guy, to come in and lay the foundation, and he brought his workers in there. And you know, people who didn't have an opportunity to bid on the big contracts could bid on our contracts, and they could actually get the contracts. So we ended up contracting out 87% of the contracts to local people. And we ended up, because we had to finish the project, and some of these people had various levels of skills, but we ended up with 55% of those contractors being able to finish this job. And I learned, you know, that, you know, it's a lot of reasons why people, you know, don't make it, you know. And all they need is a little help. Sometimes all they need is a little encouragement. And all they need is somebody to keep at it and provide that opportunity for them. When that job was finished, when that job was being built, the people in the neighborhood would just come up and hang on the gate and look in and see all these black boys down there in that hole. And, you know, and I would get so many phone calls from people saying, boy, I can't believe it. We're really doing this, you know. And there was a, you know, a renewal of hope that we can do things in our own neighborhood, that we can raise money, that we can put people back to work, that we can improve our schools. And so that is, you know, the real lesson, I think, that we learn when we do for ourselves, when we mobilize our own assets. We could not have done that if those women had not sold catfish. You know, it was better to start with what they had and build on that than to start with money given us from a grant. You know, so most of what we do, you know, the little bit that we have, people have to sow that. The Bible says that God gives seed to the sower. You know, so whoever sows that seed is the one who gets more seed. Your skills and gifts are built by you using them. If you don't use them, if you're waiting for someone else, you are the most frustrated, unhealthy person in the world. So we have to use our gifts. We have to use our capacity, because we build capacity by using our capacity. And so that's what people on the blocks have to begin to learn. And unfortunately, the media, the stereotypes, everybody communicates to us in our community that we are deficient, we're weak, we don't know, we need to have more education. But people have common sense, and these are the same people, you know, who built this city, who built our country, people who didn't have education, but just ordinary people with ordinary gifts and mobilizing those gifts because they had a vision.
Great. That's great.
We have Meg, we still have somebody on the line who's calling in.
Let me check that out. Let's see. Hello? We have one from the Chicago area on the line, I believe.
Hello, Jackie, and hello, everyone. This is Bob Scheich calling.
Hi,
I enjoyed
Bob.
Your talk, and I'm just curious about something, Jackie. Did you find that the people in the South, there was a greater willingness amongst them to help their neighbor than you find in Chicago, or is it about the same?
Well, I think at the time it was a greater willingness to help because you had a focus enemy, if you will, and it was, you know, the Ku Klux Klansman or the, you know, the target. You had a target enemy that mobilized people. And as I said, in Chicago, there was no target enemy. You know, there were good people and there were bad people. There were good people and bad people in the South always as well, you know, but people were much more open about their feelings about, you know, black folks at that time. So here, I think that it was not as clear, you know, and people felt that they had more, they didn't have to do and mobilize as much as they did. And now, you want to know about now, it's no difference now. I mean, in the South now, in Chicago now, I think that you have had the breakdown of community across the board. I mean, the breakdown of families is both in Chicago and in Mississippi. You have crime everywhere. And, you know, and people are afraid. In Chicago, people are afraid, but down South, people are afraid. So this fear, which is actually, I think, at the very root of violence in our community, you know, people always just say violence is the result of not having money or, you know, these kids are trying to make money out here or, you know, gang territory, that sort of thing. But really and truly, you know, it's I have learned that kids are carrying guns because they're afraid they're going to be shot by other kids. And they will leave gangs and they will leave drugs, but they have to have protection. So that's we were not afraid. I mean, even with Ku Klux Klansmen in the South, because we had family, we had community. So, you know, we were always, and we had hope. We had church. We had a future presented to us. We had, you know, a destiny to fulfill. We were all made to feel like we were very important to changing this community. We were very important to changing, you know, racism in America. We were change agents. Now, you know, with a dependency kind of attitude, you're waiting for change to happen to you or for you. Mm-hmm. And there is no, when I was a child, we had many black leaders, you know. You know, even as a grown-up, you know, 20 years ago, you had, 30 years ago, you had a lot of black leaders, you know. And now you look for the black leadership. You don't see them. You see a few preachers every once in a while, but people are so bogged down, you know, with their own organizational interests that, you know, where is the community? Where is the heart for the community? And so, you know, we're seeing that there is a real breakdown in community because, you know, people are, have embraced that whole dependency model and that professional model and need service model, and it's killing us, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Are there other calls, Maggie? Maggie, you there?
Sorry, I forget to unmute myself. we have no other callers waiting. If anybody else would like to call in, it's *8. We have a couple more minutes.
Jackie, I have a question. What's the economic or local business-owned landscape look now in the neighborhood? I mean, the story about having raised the money and then 80% local to build the building.
Yeah.
But describe the economic landscape a little bit now, 20 plus years later.
Yes, it's, I would say it's dire, you know. I think that it has continued to bottom out, unfortunately. It started probably in the 80s with the loss of 140,000 manufacturing jobs in the Austin community alone. And, you know, with manufacturing, Austin was heavily a manufacturing area, and with manufacturing leaving and resulting businesses of like restaurants and dry cleaners and those businesses that support manufacturing and leaving the community, you know, it has been piecemeal all the way. You have a few retail stores that have opened up, you know, of course Walgreens is there and CVS and some fast food restaurants, and you know those jobs that are there, you know those kinds of businesses are there. You know you still have the liquor stores, but by and large, you know they are unfortunately, you know not really a lot going on in terms of business.
Have you tried things to launch and support and fund locally owned businesses, because what you're describing, you know, is true everywhere with their outside owned and the money's leaving the neighborhood?
Well, you know, I talked about the business that we organized, and from
right.
When you organize businesses to have you know, contacts with people who can, you know, contract with them, you have a lot of businesses then coming in, and they're coming in with various levels of capacity. And
right.
So that was one of the areas that sort of got spun out. You know, as I said, you know, I think that not-for-profit organizations that try to do a good job, this is just it's going to sound hypocritical, but I really didn't think we should last more than 5 years. And so I wanted to just go out of business because you have to get into organizational interest if you're going to stay in business. And so as long as we could work and be community interest oriented, I felt like we could. But at some point, you know, you get You have to try to figure out how you're going to survive and how you're going to pay your bills, and the organization has to get bigger. And so it just was something I didn't want to get into. So the business network was spun out, and another group began to do business networking. And so they organized big roundtables of meetings with politicians to talk about, you know, business development. And, you know, the politicians brought various businesses to the neighborhood, but it's the same. It did not really improve the neighborhood situation, because it really has to be, I think, looking at, you know, to what degree can you create sustainable kinds of income in that neighborhood where it can turn over and over and over. And so if you get a Walgreens in there, if you get, you know, and the grocery stores are not there. So, you know, the grocery stores was a business that, you know, perhaps could have, you know, had some other kinds of links to, you know, improving the neighborhood. But it just, you know, has not really worked out. It's just a difficult job to do. It takes almost soul focus, I think, to do that. And when we were working on, you know, every block of village and working on building a health facility, we try to stay in health because, you know, when you're an organization in a neighborhood, you know, people will take you down if you try to get into schools. Your area is health. You know, we work in schools, so you have other organizations, and you don't want to get into that fight with organizations because it's distracting and very time and wearing on you.
Tough. It's amazing to listen to you, Jack. So grateful. Just there's a realism and a, you know, mixed with the hope. It's very powerful. I think that the way to create a local economy, perhaps with cooperatives or something, that's a tough nut to crack. Because to bring outside businesses in doesn't really solve the problem. So we've got a couple minutes left. John, you want to have any questions or thoughts? Or
well, one thing that I know currently is going on with the authority is the housing development process that Morris directs.
Yes, that's right.
And that's key to providing local jobs.
Yeah, last year, well, actually 2 years ago, we started to look at ways that we could take some of the abandoned houses in the neighborhood that were abandoned as a result of foreclosure. People were really on these blocks having a difficult time. They were trying to hold on to the equity in their houses, and, you know, the abandoned houses were being just neglected terribly by the banks, and they were being broken into. And so we came up with the notion that we would do 100 men, 100 homes. And these homes would be renovated by people in the neighborhood, by local businesses, and these homes would be sold to local people. So that's one of the things that we started doing. We started fundraising. To date, I think we've probably done about 17 homes. And, you know, at least 15 of them have been sold. Maybe not 15. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'm retired. I'm on the board, but I can't remember. But they have been sold. If they haven't been sold, they're being leased. And they are leased and sold. I mean, some of them, it's really wonderful because school teachers from the neighborhood now live in the neighborhood. And we were able to go on that block and help to stabilize those blocks. And we were able to start every block of village on some of those blocks and bring people. We're having a meeting tonight. We bring people out to our every block of village meeting and give them the bigger vision. But, you know, just trying to bring people who have resources back to the community and give them a good place to live at a cost that they would not be able to get, and a house at a great cost that they would not be able to buy, for example, in some suburb. And then those people who have values, those people who have education, and those people can, you know, can contribute not only in terms of paying for that house and paying taxes on that house, but they can also serve as advocates, you know, with the politicians for better schools and, you know, more opportunities in the neighborhood, better streets, you know, pick up the garbage and, you know, pick up the trees, you know, make sure that the alleys are clean and, you know, opportunities in the park district. So, you know, some of the things that they have been doing, you know, from the Every Block of Village meetings lately, they have been, you know, demanding that the fees be lowered at the park districts. Instead of saying kids can't come because the fee, they can't afford the fees, you know, they didn't pay the fee, they can't participate in the park districts. Lower the fees down in the park districts and, you know, insisting that they have better bus transportation so that if we have to leave the community to go get a job, the buses don't just run, you know, in the daytime. The buses also run nights. Some people work 11 o'clock shifts. And, you know, some of the policy kinds of things that they these people are able to espouse. So, you know, and so it's been a very interesting kind of and a wonderful kind of thing. But, you know, we have raised money. We have been raising money toward that. I think we've raised somewhere around $400,000. All of this money is being spent in neighborhood, on neighborhood contractors, neighborhood folks working. People who were once in jail now coming out of jail, and they also have to come to these meetings so that they will be a part of the community, not just a job, but they are part of a community. It's part of what we require from them.
You know, one of the things that strikes me as especially significant about everything you're saying and the Westside Health Authority and EBV manifest this is that you're bringing people together to perform two functions. One, to be advocates, right, for better transportation, for instance, but also to be involved in neighboring in ways that brings new life to people and the young people in the community, so that you have a double vision. So many organizations just have a view of advocacy, but you've been able to combine advocacy and community building in the same organization, and that's what has always impressed me as being especially important, and a lot of other organizations could learn a lot from you about how you make both those things happen.
Yeah.
So I hate to interrupt, but we're nearing the end of the hour. So, Jackie, any final things you would like to say? It's so grateful to have you on this call.
Yes, well, you know, I am very grateful for John's work, and I have to say that, you know, someone asked that question about how do you get people to stop seeing themselves as somebody and go out and help people with needs and go out here and organize folks to help. You know, so that's sort of been in the back of my mind, and I'm just very grateful for the work John has done, and you as well, because it
Thank
really
you,
did help me to begin to think this way. And I think that we have to help other people to think this way. It's hard because I think as a black woman, so many times you don't want to get caught up in a conservative mindset that, you know, these folks are victims, they're going to be victims, leave them alone, and so forth. You know, it was not always the case. I had a young man who went out, and he did some outreach on the blocks. He did some surveys, and he came back in. He's about 30. He's been in jail about four times. I put him out there after he had been mentored by me, and so we paid him to go out and do some surveys, and he came back, and he says, the people who are 55 to 65 years old, these are the people on the block. They're still picking up paper. They are still trying to help their neighbors. They are, you know, they are really hopeful, and they are really helpful. He said, the people between the ages of 45 and 55, he says, they're hopeful, but they're less helpful. And he says, and those that are 30, they are selfish. He says, they see themselves, and they buying their cars, and they're buying their jewelry, and they are competitive with their neighbors. And he says, those under 30 are not hopeful. He said, they are hopeless. And he says, and they are fearful. And he says that, so he says, I don't know how we're going to change that. That's what he says. And he is 30. And so, you know, so he is somebody in the church now. He was somebody who never went to church. He's in the church, and he's bringing his folks to church. The change that we have to have is not change that can come from the outside. It's change, and it's not even the outside of people. It's the inside, and we have to change the heart. And that is sustainable. That's the only change that is sustainable. And that is the change that helps us all to grow, you know, because when you have a passion for something, even though your leg hurt, you might have arthritis, you still get up and move because you have a passion for doing that. And when you do it, you feel better, you feel healthier, and you're more satisfied. And that's health, you know, that's being healthy, having that satisfaction and fulfillment from helping someone else and giving your gift to contribute to society. When you cannot do that, you are not healthy, and we are not in a healthy society at this point in our country, I don't think.
Oh, thank you so much, Jackie.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you
so much.
Thank
you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, Maggie, we need to...
Right. Let's to wrap up. Jackie, thank you so much. I enjoyed listening to your stories and the hope that you convey. And there's some difficulty there, but there's also some real light. And thank you for sharing that. And thank you for taking the time to be with us today. And thank you, too, to our listeners. I think we might have had a glitch with TalkShoe, and I apologize about that. But we hope you will join us again on our next call, which is going to be on October 21, and Judith Snow will be our guest. Until then, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and do stay in touch with us. So this will bring our program to a close today, and thank you again for joining. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jackie.